This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello, welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. To a four-year-old watching bulldozers at a construction site or chasing butterflies in flight, the world is awash with promise. Little kids come into the world hardwired to learn in virtually any setting and about any matter. But in today's preschool and kindergarten classrooms, learning has been reduced to scripted lessons and suspect metrics that too often undervalue a child's intelligence while overtaxing the child's growing brain. These mismatched expectations wreak havoc on the family. Parents are afraid that if they choose the wrong program, their child won't get into the right college. But Yale early childhood expert Erica Chistakis, who's our guest for this part of today's show, says that our fears are wildly misplaced. Our anxiety about our children's futures has reached a fever pitch at a time when, ironically, science is giving us more certainty than ever before that young children are exceptionally strong thinkers. In our discussion today, Erica is going to talk to us about what it's like to be a young child in America today, in a world that's designed by and for adults, where we really and truly have confused schooling with learning. They are not the same thing. And she's going to give us some real-life strategies that are going to help us get out of their way instead of cluttering up their world with more and more stuff. The Hidden Life of Preschoolers starts when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Let's hear from an identity thief.
Identities are easy to catch online. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Books them every time.
Safeguard your personal information on the phone, online, and especially at home, because half of identity theft occurs by someone you think you know. Keep your identity to yourself and take a bite out of crime. Learn more from the National Crime Prevention Council at ncpc.org.
A message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Check it out, it's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Erica Chistakis, who is the author of The Importance of Being Little, What Preschoolers Really Need from Grownups. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Armin.
You know, you mentioned just before we went on the air a concept called the preschool paradox, which I thought was an interesting phrase, and I want to have you explain it because I think it's probably going to be how we're going to jumpstart our discussion here.
Sure. Well, that's a concept that I came up with to describe a sort of puzzlement that I have observed as a teacher and as a preschool director and also as a parent and now as a faculty member at the Yale Child Study Center, which is this idea that kids are hardwired to learn in virtually any setting. And we have more and more research to confirm the incredible capacity of children to learn. So on the one hand, they're great learners, and yet the paradox is that they so often struggle in early learning settings in preschools and kindergartens. We have a real explosion of preschool expulsions, as a matter of fact. People are always really stunned to hear this, but it's a growing problem. We've got increasing numbers of young kids on various medications to control behaviors. And we have a lot of exhausted and frustrated parents. And so I was trying to understand, you know, what is going on with this paradox and how can we help to sort of harness the real strength and power in young children in a way that doesn't make the grown-ups feel crazy.
Wait, I want to have you go back for just a second. So you're talking about medicating preschool kids?
Yeah, I mean, believe it or not, some of the ADHD medications are being used sort of off-label for kids as young as 2 and 3. It's certainly very much contrary to the recommendations of the American Academy of Pediatrics and other physicians, but there is, you know, we also have a growing problem of preschool expulsions.
Yeah, what's that about?
Well, you know, I think it's very complicated. I think there are a lot of embattled teachers. There are a lot of frustrated families. But one thing that's going on is that we have what people call a push down of expectations from the upper grades. You know, we've all heard about the standards testing movement and a lot of anxieties about Common Core and before that, No Child Left Behind. But we're asking preschoolers to do a lot of things that probably aren't so developmentally appropriate. So we've got very busy schedules with lots of transitions. That's hard for young kids to cope with. We have lots of clutter in the classrooms. You know, you walk into these classrooms, and honestly, if it were an adult office space, you know, we would get OSHA involved to clean things up because it's so stressful and overstimulating. So we've got kids doing a lot of things that are stressful and frustrating and don't really reflect. You know, we have a lot of what they call seat work now, which is this bizarre concept. And I don't know if you saw in the news these kids in kindergartens where they're using little seat-based treadmills. You know,
so they don't have to bother going outside
exactly.
to get exercise. Yeah, that just is enough to kill you. Yeah,
it is.
But I want to go back to the paradox
yes.
because you know if you take this whole thing that you're saying, it's interesting. So if kids are hardwired to learn in any environment, why can't they learn in a cluttered, overstimulating environment?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. And I suppose I should have clarified, you know, when I say in any environment. I mean, I think there are things we know about how human brains work. And, you know, we know that children have an enormous capacity to learn. But nonetheless, you know, we can't so overstimulate children that they are frustrated. Now, another thing that we do with young kids, which is not optimal, is often we bore kids. You know, we ask them to do very unstimulating activities. So in a way, we have a problem of trying to identify the sort of peak, I would call it the sweet spot for learning. Everyone can learn, but when you really want to optimize learning, you have to sort of find what kids can do and what can't they do. And that involves observing them carefully, engaging with them, talking with them, listening to them. And we don't do enough of that in early childhood classrooms where the teachers are kind of running the show with a predetermined script, and you can't go off track. Kids, you know, they don't have as much play as they should. We know that conversation is really linked to learning. We know that children, when they play with blocks or when they're building a fort, or where they're playing outside doing imaginative make-believe play or what we would call roughhousing play, kids in those settings are using higher-level language structures. They're talking in a more sophisticated way. And we're just doing less. We're giving kids fewer and fewer of those kinds of opportunities to learn, I would say, optimally.
Huh. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, you think that preschool is going to be a relatively relaxed environment, but you hear so much about at the same time that there's a curriculum, and you mentioned
right.
the word curriculum, that kids are being taught stuff, and it seems like there's a lot of disagreement there about whether it should be just kind of fun to do the kinds of things that you're talking about, to get out there and do imaginative play and build your vocabulary in a non-focusing on building vocabulary kind of way.
Well, I think that's true. I think we have to be careful to understand that there isn't really a trade-off between, let's say, play and learning or fun and learning. And I think sometimes we get stuck in a mindset where we assume that schooling equals learning or that some kind of ABC kind of, you know, very scripted letter of the week kind of curriculum equals learning. And so we have to retrain ourselves to understand that actually deeper learning is going on with some of this more play-based kinds of interactions and experiences. You know, I always tell parents that I work with, you have to think of your child as a little scientist, you know. And so you can fill this child's brain with information. You can say, this week is the letter P, and we're going to read a story that begins with P, and we're going to talk about panda bears and penguins. You know, that's one way to teach. But another way to teach would be to really listen to the child, hear what they're thinking about, ask questions, get them to talk, get them to give you their hypotheses. It's a different approach. It's a different way of looking at kids.
Well, why don't people do this already, though? I mean, it doesn't seem so terribly complicated. And
well,
you have all these people who are, you know, are in the classrooms, are taking or have already taken early childhood education classes, and they're specialists, many of them in this area. Why are they, you know, feeling the need to go through a, a curriculum?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, oftentimes teachers don't really have training in the kind of teaching I'm talking about because it's not a free-for-all. You know, you're not just opening up the classroom and saying, you know, go play, kids. I mean, that's an important thing to do for children, but what I'm talking about is a more intentional kind of practice where you're really harnessing what kids can do. So if you watch a group of kids and they're really interested in cars, you know, maybe you sit down with them with some blocks and you help them figure out how to build a ramp, and then you listen to the words they're using and you sort of build your curriculum around what you're seeing. That actually does take a lot of practice. And the thing is that a lot of teachers are schooled in a particular sort of way of thinking about early education. You know, I don't know if you've ever made one of those, think back to when you were in kindergarten, if you've ever made one of those Thanksgiving turkeys where you trace
with your hand. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the teacher gives you the little googly eyes and the fluorescent feathers and you stick them on. Well, that's the way a lot of teachers have been educated to believe that they need to produce the crafts. The parents like the cutesy crafts. You know, we all want stuff to put on our refrigerator and to send to grandma. And, you know, there's not necessarily, I mean, there's no harm to come from that, but it's a missed opportunity. You know, if you think about a more sort of child-centered way of doing curriculum, you might do things very differently. You might introduce kids. Let's say it's Thanksgiving and you do want to do a turkey kind of craft. You know, you could introduce them to feathers. You could have them look in a microscope and look at feathers and what kind of patterns emerge. Or you could measure different eggs and talk about volume and how, you know, is a turkey egg different than a chicken egg? I mean, they're all. You could go to a farm, or you could get a farmer. You could get a bale of hay and put it in your classroom. And, you know, there are all kinds of more experience-based, exploratory kinds of activities that you can do that foster the sort of conversational language that I'm talking about. Kids can do measurement, they can do counting, all these things in a much more experience-based way. But the truth is that a lot of teacher prep programs aren't educating people to do that. And the other thing is that a lot of preschools are not staffed by people with the training in child development. And that gets to big public policy issues around salaries, which are extremely low. Professional development is often limited or not well constructed to help teachers grow as learners themselves. So these are kind of big, big problems.
I'm talking with Erica Christakis, who is the author of The Importance of Being Little, What Preschoolers Really Need from Grown-Ups. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Erica about preschoolers and what's going on, what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and how we as parents can take a little bit more of an active role. I'm Armin Brott. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
My dad is a hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. Then he helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see. Even when he's a little scared. My dad is a firefighter. He does great things. And the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration, a part of FEMA, reminds you to protect the heroes who protect our lives. Have a smoke alarm on every floor. Test it monthly. Replace the battery yearly. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, 60% of all fire deaths occur in a home without a working smoke alarm. The good news is, that's a fact that can change. For more information, visit the U.S. Fire Administration at www.usfa.fema.gov. Working for a fire-safe America.
In 1977, in Johannesburg, South Africa, an 8-year-old boy picked up the game of golf from his father. By the age of 9, he was already outplaying him. The odds of that same boy then making it to the U.S. and European pro golf tours? 1 in 7 million. The odds of the Big Easy winning the Open Championship once and the U.S. Open Championship twice? 1 in 780 million. The odds of this professional golfer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Ernie Els encourages you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, talking with Erica Christakis, who's the author of The Importance of Being Little, What Preschoolers Really Need from Grownups. Now, as you were talking before, I was thinking of my youngest daughter's preschool experience, and I used to go in and help out in the class as often as I could. And I was so incredibly impressed by what this teacher was doing. And she was an amazing teacher to begin with. I think they had a couple of different preschools in the school. And one of them had 24 kids, and one of them had like 30-something kids. Wow. And so my daughter was in the one with 30. And that was because this teacher was like the Pied Piper. She would just snap her fingers, and the kids would just fall into line. And so they gave her the larger group because she could do this. But the stuff she was doing in the classroom, I remember around Halloween time, I was in there, and she had the kids get pumpkins, and they would drop a pumpkin on the floor. And so then they would say, okay, well, so what's going to happen if we stand up on a chair and drop the pumpkin? What if we stand up on top of the table and drop the pumpkin? I mean, you know, that sort of thing about what you're talking about, the hypothesis. What do you think is going to happen? And then we had these little peeps, these kind of marshmallow treat kinds of things. Put them in the microwave. And what do you think is going to happen if we put them in for 10 seconds? Okay. What do you think is going to happen if we put them in for 20 seconds? And the kids were so into that, and you know, there's nothing. And you talk about this in the book. There's, you know, they are kind of like little scientists, and they're craving education. And sometimes we, I don't know, do we not just give them enough credit for being smart and being interested?
I think that's right, and I think there's so much learning that is literally hiding in plain sight. You know, and if you contrast what you're talking about, and I used to do those kind of activities in my classroom. I didn't have 30 kids, and I'm impressed by that. But you know, I would give kids little hammers and golf tees, and we would take pumpkins, and they would put on little safety glasses, and they would hammer them until they would split open, and you know, they would guess what was inside, and all the kind of things that you're talking about. I mean, that's leveraging children's natural learning impulses in a very meaningful way. And in a way, it's a mistake to say that that's not curriculum, because it is actually very intentionally planned curriculum. And I'm pretty certain that a teacher like your child's teacher with 30 kids, you know, is being very intentional about the kind of learning experiences she's giving the kids. But I think the key is that in those kind of settings, the child is helping to drive the learning, is a sort of co-investigator. I mean, the way I think of it really is that they're little scientists. And that's a lot more meaningful than having a teacher cut out construction paper triangles and say, we're going to make a jack-o'-lantern, and handing the children the little triangle pieces to glue on, which is a more standard, more traditional way. Now, the parents need to kind of educate themselves, too, because we all are pretty wedded to this idea that we're going to get these little cute projects that come home. And, you know, we often compare our child's project to the other kids in the classroom.
Of course, yeah.
You know, I mean, we're human. And so, you know, teachers feed into that sometimes unwittingly by putting everything up. You know, you'll see 20 little jack-o'-lanterns, and you can kind of see, you know, which child didn't put the triangles on the right way.
Right.
And I think it's, you know, I don't mean to mock anyone for this. I think we've all been sort of educated ourselves to believe
right.
that this is what preschool learning looks like. And so we have to kind of retrain ourselves to see these signs of learning that are hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
And the reason it's so important, it's almost so obvious that it doesn't need to be said, but I will just go ahead and say it. You know, there's signs of learning that are there that we're missing. And if you think about children who maybe aren't good at cutting or don't particularly want to do a craft or you know, we're missing an opportunity to figure out how those kids think and what's important to them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you give them something like the science experiment that you described with the pumpkins, dropping them from a distance and watching what happens to them, that kind of experience it's more open-ended. It invites more inquiry from the kids. And, you know, some children may still want to paint a pumpkin or go to the writing center and draw a picture, you know, but you're creating opportunities where a much bigger range of children are experiencing success and indeed learning.
Right.
And I think that's where, you know, to go back to the preschool paradox, this idea of, you know, why are kids so smart and yet so many of them are struggling? If you build a classroom environment where lots of kids can have success, you know, you're going to have fewer behavior problems. You're going to have
right.
fewer depressed parents. You're going to have happier teachers.
Well, that kind of gets back to a question here. So you're talking about creating an environment where all the kids can learn. So you have a situation that you talked about where, and we've talked about this on the show a lot, where kids are just being over-medicated. And part of that, it seems, has to do with teachers trying to get all the kids to behave the same way. And so some, you know, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. You've got some of them that are behaving in a way that requires more attention, so it's easier to just drug them into submission. So how do you, I mean, that's a horrible way of doing things. However, I can kind of see that if you've got situations where you've got 20 or more kids in a class, that's got to be hard for a teacher, particularly one who doesn't have a huge amount of specialized education in how to handle these things. So how can you say to them, look, you're going to have to deal with each one of these kids as an individual? It's a lot easier to just have them trace their hand.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, it's easier, the outliers who can't comply, you know, it is easier to coax them along to a different program. And that is, I mean, the solution is, of course, at the higher level. It's at the policy level. It's at the public education level where we're really informing parents about what best practices are. You know, one program that's been really successful in Connecticut is having a mental health consultant who comes into classrooms where children have been identified as having behavior problems, and it's reduced the rate of expulsions. I don't know the data on medication, but we can sort of use preschool expulsion maybe as sort of a proxy for the kind of thing you're talking about. And so that would be a specialist who comes in and really looks at the whole classroom environment. So not just looking at the child, but looking at, well, what are the practices? What are the routines? What are the transitions? You know, are there too many transitions? Is it realistic in a New England climate to ask kids to get their snowsuit on and then go out and only have 12 minutes of recess? I mean, I think you know the answer I'm going to say. It's not realistic. It's unreasonable. So there's a kind of coaching piece. And, you know, where we can help teachers who don't have the expertise and are really genuinely frustrated. And I can say as a former preschool teacher myself, you know, it's very hard sometimes to know how to help children who are struggling.
Well, Erica, what are the ramifications of all this? I mean, I think, you know, it's an interesting discussion to have in theory that we aren't teaching kids the right way, or that kids are not being exposed to things, or that we're in some ways treating them like adults and trying to cram a curriculum down their throat. I mean, just being devil's advocate for just a second, you know, you could say, well, okay, so what?
Right. I think the so what is that we have growing evidence from various studies that it really does matter. The kind of experiences that I'm talking about, giving children long stretches of time to play, to build friendships, to use rich oral language, those things actually do have downside effects. And the irony of our standards movement, which is foisting so much anxiety on 4- and 5-year-olds, is that it's the rich experience-based and conversational curriculum in the early years that in fact predicts success academically down the line. And we're seeing new studies that are showing that. And so I think the science is really behind us, that there's something there. Our society is not, we have an innovative and creative society. Our culture really demands more of young people than simply learning to trace your hand. You know, we want children to be able to think critically. We want them to have what I call transferable skills. So, you know, we want children to be able to know how to address a question, whether it's about pumpkins in kindergarten or if it's about something in college.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of transferable skills where you see something new and you say, okay, what am I looking at? I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to then try to figure out the question. That's very important to the functioning of our society.
Yeah.
And from my perspective, the good news is that the science is really backing this up. I think a lot of us felt intuitively that what happens in kindergarten really matters, but now we're seeing evidence. So we have some science behind us, and that's very exciting. And I think that we need to start putting the research base into practice.
You know, Erica, we only have just a couple seconds, so give me a one-word answer to this one. Is the onus on the parents or the teachers?
Oh, gosh, it's both. It's both. Relationships matter, and so parents need to build those, and teachers need to build them, too, with children.
Erica Kostakis is the author of The Importance of Being Little, What Preschoolers Really Need from Grown-Ups. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It kind of freaks me out that some people actually go through their trash to pull out recyclables. That's not for me.
Maria Inez Phillips talks about not recycling.
I've got too many newspapers and magazines and catalogs in there with plastic containers and bottles and cans.
In your recycling bin?
No, in my trash.
Your trash can is full of recyclables?
No, it's full of trash.
You say trash, Maria. I say rubbish.
Whatever it is, I'm not going through it. I don't even know what they do with recyclables.
They make more of the things you use, Maria. More newspapers, more bottles and cans.
Out of a bunch of trash? I just don't get it.
Some things are very obvious, Maria. Recycling creates jobs and protects the environment. Is that important to you?
It is, which is why I put my trash where it belongs.
Learn the difference between trash and recycling and more on our website, yougottabekidding.org.
I put out way too much trash to think about recycling.
See why recycling is not rubbish. Visit yougottabekidding.org today.
Hey there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and you know what? Let's talk toys for a little bit here. Now, with much of the United States spending a lot of time indoors because of the incredible cold out there, it's important to think about what the kids are doing to entertain themselves. Here are a few of our current favorite toys to while away the winter. Star Wars Hero Mashers from Hasbro. Hasbro's previous masher sets have included Spider-Man, Jurassic World Dinosaurs, and Transformers, so Star Wars couldn't have been too far behind. Oddly enough, only the male characters are available, though. Despite that glaring oversight, especially for those of us who have daughters, these toys are amazingly fun and they give kids hours of play acting out favorite episodes and comics and making up their own adventures. These figures are nicely articulated, and they're fully interchangeable, so you can swap heads and arms and weapons and anything else you can think of to create your very own ultimate hero or villain. The only thing that would make them better would be to bring on Rey and Black Widow and Jessica Jones, of course, without the booze and the drugs, and the other leading ladies of heroism. Women matter, don't they, anyway? Hey, without Rey, how does the Force awaken anyway? Prices vary, and you can find out more at Hasbro.com. Marvel Legends Infinite Series, also from Hasbro. Aha! If you're looking for those female action figures, they're over here, sitting on shelves right next to the guys. So now Wasp, Spider-Girl, and a few others can join your child in adventures with Ant-Man and Spider-Man and Iron Man and Venom and everybody else. The Infinite Series is great for a number of reasons. First, the figures look really a lot like their characters. And second, the line also includes some hard-to-find characters. Third, all the figures are nicely articulated and seem to be begging for you to pick them up and play with them, as opposed to some of those collector edition toys you see around that look great on the shelf but won't stand up to being tossed around. Fourth, when you buy one, you get a bonus piece, an arm, a head, or something else that you can use to build a whole new toy once your collection is complete. Hey, why wait for Marvel to create a new superhero when you can do it yourself? They cost about $20 at places like Toys R Us. Digibirds from Spin Master. These friendly birds are adorable, and they come in a variety of breeds, colors, and packages. You can get owls, penguins, chicks, and other ones one at a time in multi-packs and in sets that include a bird cage, an igloo, or other habitat of some kind. There are so many options that your child can assemble a whole chorus of tweeting friends. Digibirds dance, bop, chirp, sing, hop, either alone or ensembles with their buddies, and they do pretty much everything else real birds do but fly and, well, you know what. Your child can blow into the included whistle ring to get the party started, or she can place two birds close together and they'll automatically sync up and start singing together. Want to expand the bird's repertoire? You can just download the free Digibirds app. Prices start at about $11 at stores like Walmart, Kmart, and you can learn more at digibirds.com. We'll be back next week with an all-new Parents at Play segment or an Ask Mr. Dad segment, but you don't have to wait that long because you can go online to parentsatplay.com and find reviews of many, many toys and games that are great for families to do together.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.